I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast. Thanks for joining us. Today on the Addiction Psychologist, we have Dr. Barbara McCrady joining us. Barbara is a professor emerita of psychology and the Center on Alcohol, Substance Use, and Addictions at the University of New Mexico. She's going to be talking to us about her groundbreaking work on alcohol behavioral couples therapy.
All right, Dr. Barbara McCrady, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you today. It's going to be a great episode with a fantastic topic and an amazing researcher. But before we really dive into the topic that we're here to talk about, would you mind just telling us a little bit about your training history?
I'd be very happy to. I did my undergraduate work at Purdue in biology. I was pre-med. This is sort of goes to the end in terms of important messages to trainees. But when I was pre-med, there were 7 medical schools in the country that took women. And I got discouraged by that. So I went on, I worked in a developmental neuroanatomy lab for 2 years. And during that time, I discovered clinical psychology. Moved to the East Coast with my husband to avoid, so he could avoid the draft by getting a draft deferred job. And then we lived in Rhode Island, and I found that the University of Rhode Island was just starting a doctoral program in clinical psychology. So I was naive enough to just go over there and see if I could get in. And they it took a year or so, but I did get in and did my graduate work there. And with a lot of focus on families and social systems, kind of the ways systems can influence individual behavior. While I was at in graduate school, I did a practicum at Butler Hospital, which is an affiliate of Brown University. And among other things, worked a little bit with a psychiatrist there named Tom Paolino. I went off to internship at Worcester State Hospital. And during that year, Tom got a grant from the state of Rhode Island to study a treatment to jointly admit people with alcohol use disorder and their spouses to the hospital, and asked me if I'd like to be the project coordinator. And I said, I don't know anything about alcohol use disorder, which then we called alcoholism. And he said, well, nobody else does either. So I said, but I do know something about research and I know something about families. So I took the position as the project coordinator and designed the research side of it, ran that study, finished my degree while I was doing that. And then, we had not quite finished the study. We still needed to do follow-ups and data analysis. And I was planning to go on and be a community organizer and do like really be a community psychologist. But I had the opportunity to take a faculty position at Brown. And I thought, well, I'll do this for 3 or 4 years and see what I think. and during that time, I pretty much fell in love with research that meant something. Yeah. Dave Barlow had just come to Brown and to Butler Hospital as the chief psychologist. He was a little skeptical about me because he said, what are your goals? And I said, well, I want to continue to do this research and develop my clinical skills. And he said, well, don't you want to climb the academic ladder? And I said, well, it's not that important to me. So he was afraid that I wasn't ambitious. He was wrong.
Yeah, I would say so.
And he has teased me my whole career about climbing up the academic ladder with one hand over my eyes saying, I'm not doing this. And then I stayed at Brown for, including the year as a project coordinator, 9 years, and then moved to Rutgers where I took a position as a faculty member in the Graduate School of Applied and Professional Psychology, which is the PsyD program, and at the Center of Alcohol Studies, which is as a clinical director. I stayed there for 24 years, and then I moved, and during that time, I was the director of clinical training for the PhD program and chaired the psychology department as well for a couple of years. And then I moved to University of New Mexico as the director of CASA, the Center on Alcohol, Substance Use and Addictions, and as a faculty member in the psychology department. And I stepped down as director of CASA 3 years ago and officially retired last June, and I'm now a professor emerita and work 25% on my research and doing a bunch of writing and one volunteer thing. I serve on the county's Addiction Treatment Advisory Board. So it's a way to, I think, give back some of my scientific knowledge to the greater community.
Yeah, well, life really happens fast. Well, research happens fast, right? You know, all of a sudden you think you're going to be a community organizer. You think you're going to be a full-time therapist or something. And all of a sudden you spend, you know, several decades in a research career.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, your reputation precedes you in multiple areas. Mm-hmm. When I was at Brown at Butler Hospital, they still talk about you at the alcohol and drug addiction partial hospitalization program. To this day, it's the stuff of legend for sure. Honestly, was one of the best training experiences I ever had in my entire career, and absolutely love Butler Hospital and Brown. And then you've kind of touched a bunch of things along the way, right? Rutgers Center, the Center in New Mexico, so forth and so on. And so I think it's safe to say David Barlow isn't wrong a lot, but in this particular case, rare miss.
I would say he was wrong in the sense that I've never been driven by promotions or, you know, what do I need to do to get this thing or that, or this honor or that honor or that this position or that position. I've always been driven by the work and what I care about.
And that's really important, I think. And honestly, the people I think that have had some of the biggest impact, like yourself in the field, have that similar motivation, right? Like it's not all about the hustle. It's about making a difference with communities and with people that we care about, right? And I think that really shines through your work and in your writing and in your advocacy work along the way that I've encountered throughout my career and has really inspired me. I started reading your stuff when I was an undergraduate, actually, and was really inspired by it. And so I'm just so honored to have you on the show and really excited about our conversation. And I know you've been kind of responsible for like numerous groundbreaking studies and work along the way. And we wanted to spend, you know, we could spend whole episodes talking about numerous areas that you've been involved with. But today we're hoping maybe we could focus on some of the work you've done with substance use in the family context and some, you know, partner involved interventions for substance use disorder. I know you already kind of spoke a little bit about how some of that stuff showed up for you as a project coordinator, so forth and so on. But I was wondering if maybe you could just tell us a little bit about why that work is so important.
Oh boy, that's sort of a day of conversation. But I think people exist within systems. People exist within communities. And sometimes those are little communities like your family, and those are bigger communities like your, you know, your friend network, and larger communities like the community you live in, the community you work in, and so on. And I think for us to think about change in almost any kind of psychological disorder, but certainly alcohol use disorder, to think that change could occur without, in a vacuum, without that community, is naive in some sense. And so the idea that we can engage people in treatment themselves, but if they go every day they leave our therapy office, they're interacting with their friends, they're interacting with their family, and so on. And so the treatment itself, I think, needs to both prepare a person for that and help them know how to work with that. And, you know, some other people like Mark Litt has done really interesting work with network-focused therapy, where he's just working with the individual and helping them develop those skills to interact differently with their social environment. And my approach has been to say, let's just at least get part of the social environment in there and really see if we can do a number of things to help them change. And I think I'll stop there so that you can ask me questions instead of me giving a lecture.
No, I think that's an important thing, right? Like, I think maybe it's part of the culture of the United States or Western culture in general, but, and I think it's really showing up for us right now as we think about COVID and public health in that way, right? But, you know, so much of this is placed on the individual level, right? Individual decisions to use or to drink, right? And, you know, I think this really came through, especially when I worked at Butler, where, you know, we had like a whole family group, right, where we brought families in and kind of talked to them about what the experience of the individual who has an alcohol use disorder or a substance use disorder is like, but also kind of garnered their experience and used that to help craft an understanding for the individual who had the use disorder to understand what it's like for their support system to watch this happen and to feel like they can't help or to feel nervous about saying this or that or to communicating in specific ways. And just really feel like they don't know how to respond to this or how to help support them. And that, you know, they get messages from other people like tough love and all these other types of things or enabling or these types of words, which are not really evidence-based. And I think that that doesn't get talked about a lot in, you know, in psychological interventions, right? But it's just a fabric of how people live their lives, right? Like everybody that leaves my office goes right back into their family environment. And if we're not talking about how you're going to deal with that, then we're not setting them up for success, right? And that's a failure on my part as a therapist to not even consider those types of things. And these types of interventions really kind of pull that in directly as kind of a mechanism of change, it sounds like.
Right, right, exactly. That's so cool that you had that experience of actually hearing what families have to say and hearing the things that they struggle with. So it sounds like you'd like me to talk a little bit about mechanisms.
Please.
Or hypotheses about mechanisms.
Please. Yeah. Why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the concepts that some of these theories are built on?
Right. Okay. So I'd say that there are probably two major kind of concepts that drive the alcohol behavioral couple therapy. One is really a functional analytic approach and really kind of connecting what's going on in the environment, what are the stimuli, what's going on inside the individual, cognitively, affectively, physiologically, what role does alcohol play, what are the positive and negative consequences, both for the individual, both, you know, kind of internally or intra-individually, as well as the consequences that come from their family and then from their larger social environment. So I always think about it in those kind of those three elements. And then the other major concept is really general systems theory, in which, or I should say family systems theory to be a little bit more specific, in which you always understand any behavior you observe in an individual as occurring within a systemic concept or within a system. So the easy way that I always explain this to people is to say, if you have a husband and a wife, being really simplistic, and the male has the alcohol use disorder, and he says, I drink because she nags. And she says, I nag because he drinks. And it's a perfect circle of influence between the two of them. And they're both correct in terms of their perception. So within alcohol behavioral couple therapy, we give them a functional analytic framework to really understand, you know, that their drinking is the behavior is understandable. It's not simply a biological drive. It's not bad behavior. It's not a moral failing. So the functional analysis gives both partners some understanding of why does this happen? And then what we're trying to do is help each of them understand, like, okay, what are major triggers? And probably one of the harder parts of the treatment is to work around things like spousal triggers, partner responses to drinking without there being any assignment of blame or responsibility. And we've worked really hard in terms of our treatment manuals to have really clear instructions, and explaining to when we want to have a partner come in to say basically what I said earlier, which is, well, you know, your partner's drinking occurs, you know, in this family context, and you're influenced by it. And we know if you're here too, you'll understand more about it. You'll understand that how to support the way he changes, and he'll also understand more about what you're experiencing. And we always are very explicit about saying, you, each of you is responsible for your own behavior. You are not responsible for the other person. And, you know, change in drinking is ultimately the responsibility of the person who's drinking. And then we also say, you know, like, if you have a better relationship, it's going to be, there's going to be a lot more motivation for the person who had the alcohol use disorder to maintain changes in their drinking, and you're going to be happier. So we, you know, we really try to weave those, the family systems concepts in by, you know, really talking about how they react to each other and how much the drinking has perturbed that family system. And then the functional analytic framework gives us a way to really, really kind of break down what's going on and help make discrete behavior change for each of them in ways that we think works.
Yeah, I think the cyclical nature of this can really get lost in the weeds sometimes. You know, I learned about this just in more general couples therapy, in the context of ironic processes or ironic problem solution loops, you know, where you want something, and the behavior that you do to get it causes something that actually is what you don't want. And then that just sort of process continues between the two partners. Right. And your point about just the blame is, I think, is so critical, because like when you do bring those things up, in the context of a relationship, you know, it's, you're basically saying either, you know, either I am doing this and that's why you're acting that way, or you're doing this and that's why I'm acting that way. And that can be really hard in the context of, ABCT or alcohol behavioral couples therapy, not to be mixed up with the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapy. How do you sort of, I guess, like in the moment, in the session, how do you deal with that blame?
Sorry, I got distracted for a moment. My dog was barking. No worries at all. Probably got recorded, but it's
no worries.
A nice dog. how do we deal with the blame in the session? So I'm going to say sort of the negative part of this first, which is that we found with some couples, when we start taking a functional analytic frame and, you know, I'm helping kind of describe like what kinds of things can influence the drinker's behavior. We've had some partners who say, you're taking them off the hook. You know, they drink because they want to, they drink because they're an addict, or they use drugs because they're an addict. And so, you know, it's sort of an interesting process, because you know, when you're doing couple therapy, you're always trying to balance your relationship with each partner and with the couple as a unit. You know, you basically have three alliances during the treatment, which is kind of an interesting balance to try to maintain. And so one of the blame issues we've experienced, or I've experienced certainly, is partners not liking the idea that there's kind of understandable laws of learning that influence why the person drinks,
right,
or uses. And so
and that they are sort of a part of that landscape.
Right. Well, actually, yeah, they don't like that either. but kind of dealing with the first part of it, which is the, you know, the like, don't take them off the hook. We circle around to, yeah, of course the person is responsible for their behavior, but you need to have a way, you need to find a pathway to change. And using this kind of framework helps find a pathway instead of just saying, well, he drinks because he wants to, which who knows, might partially be true, or she drinks and she's a terrible mother or whatever. You know, we'll say, we break it down. And this, you know, it's a typical kind of behavioral approach to almost any kind of problem. It's like, let's figure out what situations are difficult, what skills do you need? And then just kind of really underscoring the responsibility part again. Now, the blaming each other part is also obviously tricky. And again, our framework is to say, like in any relationship, there are things that each person does that the other person really doesn't like. and are annoying and are frustrating. And there's some things a person does over and over, you know, kind of that drive you crazy throughout your life or throughout your relationship. And this is really a concept, you know, that comes a lot from John Gottman's work and from the integrative behavioral couple therapy, which is to say, certainly some things that your partner does are never going to change. But our goal is to figure out, like, where can we really stimulate change, create change, help you make changes that are going to make things better. But then we keep circling back to, but each of you is responsible for yourself. And since I know you guys have some experience with couple therapy, you know, the most common thing that happens in any couple therapy, not just with alcohol use disorder, is each person comes in with their plan for how the therapist will change the other person. You could just get her to not talk so much.
Right.
And, you know, she's just like, yak, yak, yak. I can't stand it.
Everyone's always perfect. It's always the other person.
Yeah. Oh, if you could just get him to not walk out of the room or pick up, you know, like pick up his phone and you know, play a video game when I'm trying to talk to him. So it's that kind of concept that is common across couple therapy that also comes up with alcohol use disorder. But the one wrinkle is that we are trying to change one person's behavior at the beginning, the first part of the treatment anyway, which is trying to help you change the drinking. And I will say that's the other, maybe the third leg of dealing with the blame issue, which is we always have partner interventions lagging the identified patient interventions. So the idea being, your partner has come to treatment and you're coming along, and that's a big step. And now she's trying to make some changes in her drinking. Maybe you could do a little bit to, you know, support her in that. But, you know, we're looking for a little bit of change in the person with the alcohol use disorder before we ever ask the partner to make any changes in their behavior. And so that keeps the responsibility for the drinking front and center, and our emphasis is on support initially, as opposed to change for the spouse.
Yeah, that makes total sense. That makes total sense. I think, I think so much of this underlying framework here is very helpful, right? Like, it's just about, like, the key is trying to deliver the message to the audience, right? And couple therapy is just like, there's more things happening in the room and more alliances. And, you know, I was always trained to, like, the relationship is the client, right? Or the patient, right? And not the individual person, which is super tricky, right? But I think that the functional analytic framework here is just like such essential kind of centerpiece to this, right? Like that, like, hey, behavior doesn't happen on accident.
Right.
That, like, people do things because they serve a function for them. Right. And helping everyone understand that the things that we do that other people like or don't like have as a function for the person who started that behavior. Right. So, like, you know, the person that's nagging, for instance, like, they do that for a reason. And so, like, what is their reason? What are we trying to understand underneath what they're doing that we helps us unlock this next level of your relationship? What's going on with the drinking? Why are we drinking? They're making individual decisions to drink, for sure. But there's also all this other stuff that's going on, right? Like neural adaptations that make craving and other parts, processes of inhibiting this behavior more challenging. So that's not in isolation. Help them understand those types of things, right? Or, like, just so essential to helping everybody. And nobody likes the taste of that at the beginning of these things, right? Like, whenever I've done family therapy, or couple therapy in this way, right? Like, when I deliver that message, everybody's like, ew, I don't like that. I really just wanted you to, like, fix them and I would be, like, way better, right? Like, when I do, like, parent and child therapy a lot, they'd be like, I was thinking they thought of it like dry cleaning, like they drop their kid off and pick them up clean, right? And, like, that's just not how it works, right? Like, they're using at your home and happening in the context, and the way that you relate with them is part of the process that's sustaining this, or at least it can be. And let's help understand ways that you can be, instead of a sustaining factor, right, a change factor for them, right? And helping them really kind of link those pieces together and understanding, right, this family system is essential. And one of the ways that somebody explained it to me initially was like plumbing, where, like, you're gonna, like, you have a leaky pipe in the system and you, like, fix that leak, it pushes pressure on all kinds of other things in the pipe system that wasn't having pressure before, because that leak was allowing the pressure to be kind of released over there, now gets put over here. And so we got to pay attention to, once we start making these changes, how people respond to them and start talking about our motives and our thinking out here in the open in the session, to help us bypass some of these particular pressure points that are going to be like, well, I did this and they didn't do that, and you told me that'd be like this. And it becomes a real challenge along the way. And it sounds like in part your treatment is designed to help us kind of step through some of those types of things. And so I was wondering maybe if you could tell us a little bit about, just kind of give us like an aerial view of the treatment structure and some of the kind of maybe the major kind of modules along the way to help our listeners kind of understand what this would look like.
Sure. I have to say, I love the plumbing analogy. It's not one I've ever thought of or used. I'm going to digress just for a moment.
Let's do it.
To your question, which is the, in one of our studies, we did some focus groups, and we asked patients, you know, what they would think of having their family involved in treatment. We asked family members what their concerns were, and then we asked therapists. And one of the things that, you know, that came out of that really clearly was that patients kind of who were already in treatment would like they wanted their families involved, but they thought their families wouldn't want to be involved. And families wanted to be involved, but they didn't think that the patient would want them involved. And that to me was just one of the most fascinating parts of that. And so, you know, part of the challenge, of course, is to get the family members to come. And the other thing I am continuing on my digression for a moment with a story, which is when I was running the problem, then was called the Problem Drinkers Program at Butler Hospital. We did an interview with a family, with a wife, and she said that her husband would beat her when he was intoxicated, and he had blackouts and he didn't know. And he would always say, what happened to you? And she'd say, oh, you know, I'm clumsy. You know, a lot of the things that the battered women will often say to cover up. And after a little while in the treatment, which is a day hospital treatment, so she was involved part of the time, but he was getting, you know, treatment 5 days a week. We had a session where she told him what was actually happening. And it was one of the most powerful moments in any treatment I think I've ever done, because he was like fundamentally this really good guy who was horrified, you know, that he could ever hurt his wife. And he stayed sober. He used to come back and visit us and things like that. And for me, that kind of crystallizes that some of what happens in should happen in treatment, which is this increasing level of honesty between them. So overview of the treatment itself, we do a really good assessment. Most of the assessment we do together. And so we start from the beginning with the message that, you know, this is a joint effort. And it's kind of interesting doing a timeline follow back with a partner there also. And they're like, oh, no. or they're saying, oh, you were drinking then? I didn't know that. I kind of wondered. And from the beginning, we say to them, one of the things that will happen in treatment is you will learn things that you didn't know. And you might be surprised by
that point. Yeah.
You might be surprised and you might be angry. But it's part of the process of the treatment. It's part of one of the best processes in the treatment is that honesty between the two of you. So we do a good assessment with them together. We do a intimate partner violence assessment separately with, you know, with each of them in a separate room, because we want to make sure that it's safe to do the treatment conjointly. And if there's been significant violence to the point of creating, you know, injury that either required medical attention or should have, or if either partner says they're afraid of retribution if they're seen together, if they're seen with their partner, then we won't see them together. And we ask a few other things during that individual assessment about like their own concerns and, you know, a little bit of their background, so that if it looks like the IPV is severe enough that we shouldn't see them together, we kind of have a cover story, if you will. And we're able to say, you know, it looks like each of you has some really significant individual concerns, and we think you'd do better not starting out with couple therapy. So that's a really important before we actually do any sessions, that assessment and that decision-making is important. the treatment itself starts with really introducing, giving them some feedback about from the assessment. And the assessment does include the ways that the partners coped, as well as relational concerns. So we give them feedback in all three of those areas. And again, they're together for that. We always, like good couple therapists, we're always asking both of their reactions. Typically, you know, one person is going to be the talker and the other one isn't. And so with, again, this is very much a general couple therapy thing, but we're always asking the other person, you know, what's your perspective? What are your thoughts about this? And we're doing some very rudimentary couple therapy right from the beginning, because people interrupt each other and things like that. And we say nice things like, gee, hold on just for a second. I really want to hear what Sam has to say here. You know, don't worry, you know, Maria, I really want to hear what you have to say too. So, you know, and I do use a lot of hand gestures. I put one, you know, my hand up to stop one of them or the other. Just to kind of slow them down a little bit. So as I said, the couple, you're doing couple therapy from the beginning. We then start with introducing the functional analysis and helping them get that framework for understanding the drinking. And start with really drinking related interventions, ways to decrease their drinking or stop, depending on what their goal is. We have a whole protocol for helping people step down their drinking over a couple of weeks, with just cutting down day by day. And we're real specific about it. What are you going to do? How are you going to do this? If you buy a case of beer a day, what are you going to do instead? Oh, could you buy, you know, 2 6-packs? And people come up with all these kind of funny things. Well, it's cheaper by the case. And it's like, yeah, but if you're going to drink
less. But you drink a lot of it.
right. You're still going to save some money if you're only buying 2 6-packs. Right.
That's a great point.
So they're all, there are all sorts of ways. But anyway, so we really work a lot on that. And other kind of basic skills, helping them with self-management planning to really think about how they're going to deal with specific situations. Do some cognitive restructuring work, particularly around how they think about alcohol, some affect, affect regulation skills. And these kind of go all the, like through probably 2/3 of the therapy. At the same time, after the first or second session, we've changed our protocol a few times. So it depends on which protocol I'm thinking about, but we start with a real basic, partner intervention, which is, can you do something, communicate something positive to the drinking partner about anything? If it's like, nice shave this morning, or, I like the haircut you got this week, or whatever, but anything, just something, some very little kind of positive. But we also ask the drinker to communicate something positive to their partner so that it feels like it's a balance.
Oh no, go ahead. Sorry. I'm just sort of collecting response, like thoughts. So, but go ahead.
Absolutely love attending to the positive. That's like one of my favorite parts of doing the couple or family based intervention for substance use disorder, right? Like, is to teach them how to talk to each other in this way. And it really just kind of like lathers them up for talking about some of the other parts that are going to be less helpful, right? Or more challenging to talk about, like you're doing this thing and it's very painful or this type of stuff, right? But to say like, hey, tending the positive, what we do great, what happened this week, even if it's just something simple, teaching them this channel of communication is essential for change.
And it's
often a message that's not, when I talk about that with people, I often say like, some of the stuff I'm going to ask us to try on is going to seem so obvious that it couldn't possibly work. And that's exactly often why people haven't tried it and exactly why it will. It's, pretty low barrier. Why don't we just try this on, see how it goes. And then most people always describe that later on after everything's kind of over as like, wow, I didn't think that was going to work, but it was so essential to helping me think about my partner and helping me kind of pay attention to both sides of the coin along the way. And so I'm so glad that that's like woven into the fabric of the beginning of your treatment.
No, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. We also have an intervention we call Notice Something Nice, where they just, we have them just, oh, I should also say, we have them do self-monitoring all the way through. So the drinker is monitoring drinks, urges, and relationship satisfaction. And the partner also is monitoring. Hmm. And they do, we have them do ratings of drinking, like none, low, moderate, high, their estimate of urges, and also their relationship satisfaction. And we do that because we know that the partner is watching. Yeah. And they're trying to figure out, what, you know, was she drinking or not? And, you know, I'm pretty sure she was. And we figure we might as well just put that out in the open rather than you know, having it be this secretive behavior.
Yeah.
And the asking the partner to monitor urges, they're kind of baffled by that, but it's really interesting because it forces them to think about the fact that this is a tough process, mm-hmm. and that is not just like, okay, I stopped or I cut back and no big deal. Yeah. It's like, I'm struggling with this. So it's sort of, it's a way, there's another way to kind of create empathy between them. We then kind of, in terms of the sort of low level interventions, we also then start with the kind of finding something positive to do together. Yeah. And we've used Gottman's old fun deck forever. And surprisingly, people love that. It's all, and we've added things to it and we've taken some things out. It was created in the 70s by, you know, some Caucasian middle-aged men in the Northwest. So, you know, they're kind of a specific population in terms of things they would think were fun for couples. So we've added to it. But they like that. Couples find the and we try to have them pick something that's, we think they can do.
Yeah.
Say like, okay, go out for dinner and have like a long, like lovely evening without alcohol is usually beyond people's capabilities at the beginning. So we're kind of building that in, that building the positive. And then about the fourth session or so, and I'm kind of talking about our 12 session protocol, around the fourth session, we start to do a couple of things that engage the spouse a little bit more. One is in more related to the drinking. So one is to talk, help, have them think about how this partner could help the drinker with urges. And that's a really interesting, it's a difficult conversation because they've never really usually haven't thought about that. Usually the drinker doesn't want to say, I feel like drinking, because they think they're going to get punished by the partner because the partner will be upset. And the partner's like, I don't know what to do. So we have that conversation and we always start with the drinker saying, could you envision yourself, you know, saying to your partner, I'm having a tough time or I feel like drinking. Now by now, they've been recording for about four sessions. So the partner has a clue that urges exist.
It's happening, yeah.
Yeah. And then we'll say to the drinker, what might be helpful? What could your partner do that might be helpful?
Yeah.
And then if the person suggests something halfway reasonable, we will then say to the partner, what do you think about that? What do you think would be helpful? Because usually if we ask the partner first, the partner comes up with like things like saying, don't drink. Or, you know, I guess if you're feeling like drinking, the treatment's been a waste. But anyways, we have them, and then we actually role play it in the session so that they practice it.
That's
and
great.
It's very hard, remarkably hard for them to do it. I've always been amazed by that. So we do that. And then we also have them talk about what they're going to do about having alcohol in the house. So we're now kind of getting like shifting into interventions that are more couple oriented with related to the drinking. And then we're also during these sessions, these middle sessions, like kind of sessions about 4 to 7 or so, 4 to 6, we're helping the partner begin to identify behaviors of theirs that might serve as triggers for drinking or reinforcers for continued drinking. Mm-hmm. And we start brainstorming as a group, the three of us, about things that could go, ways that they could do that differently. And it's always like, what are you willing to do in terms of change? Do you think this will be helpful, you know, for the partner and to the drinker, do you think this would be helpful? And we do that with any intervention. The person who's gonna be making the behavior change is the first person to drive what they're going to do. And then these interventions really continue through a good part of the treatment. But the as I said, always doing these kind of low-level couple interventions. And then we really move very much into couple therapy, introducing them to good and bad communication, helping them think themselves about what's good and bad in their communication, and then using simple exercises like reflective listening exercises, XYZ feedback. We introduce the concept of acceptance. It's not an acceptance-related treatment, but we at least introduce that. And then we move into the relapse prevention part. And again, as with everything else, there's for the drinker, what kinds of things can you do to prevent relapse? Or if you have a lapse, what can you do for the partner? What about you? What are warning signs? And for the couple, what can you do? And that's the treatment. Trying to make it sound simple, but it's really not.
Yeah. Well, you know, anytime, well, therapy is pretty complicated, but then you bring two people into the room and, you know, it's not additive. It's multiplicative. It just becomes monumentally more complicated. But what really strikes me about your explanation is that this is very holistic. And in many ways, the alcohol part is almost secondary, not necessarily, but like really what is important is sort of dismantling these entrenched patterns of reinforcement between the couple and repairing the relationship, and really focusing on alcohol as the primary, sort of point of contention between the couple.
But, I'd say yes and no. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
go ahead.
The changing the drinking is important part of the treatment,
right?
And you know, if you don't attend to that, then none of the other things can really happen, because there's so much tension and animosity around the drinking itself. And you know, the individual is who's been drinking has been suffering.
Yeah.
So it's kind of this combination of the system change and that individual behavior change.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose that one influences the other, but really you're allowing them space to like be accepting of one another as a couple, to start to give each other positive feedback, in a way that once the alcohol, you know, and it's talked about from the beginning, but as alcohol comes up, it's a space where they can have that open and trusting and safe place where they can play with it and make changes and make mistakes. And I think that's a really special part about this treatment. The other thing that you brought up at the very beginning, which I really appreciated, and in the other times when we've had people come on to talk about therapy, I don't know if it's been really just touched on as much, are some things that aren't necessarily like part of a protocol or part of a treatment, but that are sort of these basic ways of being with clients that can set your therapy up for success, like cues in therapy, like starting to hold up your hand at times after saying like, hold on. And then, you know, setting these boundaries where you're setting the standard, for what's going to happen when they come in. And that was something that I thought was really special that you discussed and that is an important part of therapy that doesn't always come across like in a manual.
It's interesting. I learned some things about using your body in therapy from Carlos Slusky, who's a systems therapist. And he gave a talk at Butler Hospital. We'd organized a conference on marriage and family therapy, which is, we didn't say couples in those days. Anyway, he got on the stage to talk about like doing family therapy. And he was like bouncing around the stage and, you know, talking to saying that you use your body as part of the treatment. And if you're having trouble getting one person to talk, you know, you lean towards them and you make them sit closer together. You make them sit further apart, or you cross your legs or you don't cross your legs. And I mean, he was very specific about a lot of the ways as a therapist, you use your own being to influence what's happening in the therapy session. And it was a 1-hour talk that's obviously stuck with me for a very, very long time. It was a great thing to learn.
Yeah, I couldn't sounds like more. It made your therapy, enhance the therapy as well.
Yeah, I've even stood up in the middle of a therapy session, and when I've had people arguing to the point where I couldn't get them to stop, and I've stood up and said, "Stop." And one time I walked out of the therapy room. I was like, you know, this is not really therapy right now. I can't get you guys to stop. So let me know when you're ready for me to come back in.
Wow.
They were so shocked that they came out very quickly.
We're ready.
Yeah.
You have to be flexible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you're talking about behavior therapy, right? Like we're a stimulus in the room and using all of the parts that I have at my disposal to be able to do those types of things. And I think it's really imperative to do that, right? Like just like, you know, the joining stuff that we do, right? Like leaning in, leaning out, hand gestures, all that kinds of stuff, eye contact, all that stuff can just be really helpful, especially because they're new to therapy, but they're not new to people, right? Like, I don't know this content we're talking about. I've never done this, but I have been around people. And so you can kind of alert right. them what's expected by doing, you know, different body language related actions that communicate to them what's expected. Right. There's multiple channels of communication happening simultaneously, and you can kind of put them at ease or encourage them to take risks and things like that through this. And I think that's so important, especially when you have multiple agendas in the room and people who want to talk. It's not just you and the client anymore talking, right? Like it's, you know, two people and you, and we may not all have the same agenda on any given day. And so it can just be so helpful. And I love that, like stop them. That's one of the hardest things to do, frankly, is to like interrupt people in yeah. therapy with, and feel like, especially when you're like a trainee, I think it was like so hard at the beginning. It was like,
right.
And then like, they just like took that and just talked for the whole time. And I didn't get any of the stuff that we planned for right. today.
Yeah.
And learning how to do that so hard.
I teach trainees about some of the, like, you know, some of the, like using hand gestures and just
yeah.
putting your hand up with a stop message. And the quieter or, you know, more reserved therapists are kind of, they're like, really, I can do that? It's like, of course.
Yeah.
But in couple therapy also, they're used to talking to each other. They have a whole set of communication, like ways of communicating that you're trying to interrupt. And so you have yeah. to, you can't sit there. The one thing I forgot to mention is that at the end of every session, we talk with them about what high-risk situations are coming up for the week and help them plan for how they're going to handle some of them. And that really gets them into the idea that, you know, that this is a process, change is a process, and things are going to happen all the time. And we did one, Kevin Hallgren is a former student of mine, did this really cool analysis looking at a couple of our different studies and how long it took for somebody to start drinking at all after a session. And once we started doing the high risk situation stuff, it really cut
wow.
back on that between session drinking. So it's an intervention I just love that we kind of developed over time and that people seem to really find helpful.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, high risk situations I think are just so helpful. And some of that, you know, Marlatt based relapse prevention stuff is just like so crucial. Like those are conversations that just haven't happened. Like they're used to talking to each other, but not about that. Mm-hmm. Right. And exactly. like once you get them that have a common language around to talk about those issues, it really opens up all these new possibilities for support and for intervention on both members of the yeah. kind of family, which I find are just really where the power, and like in kind of like sustained change lives a lot of times mm-hmm. is when they're like able to kind of unify against the substance use disorder versus like, oh, you're drinking or all these different types of things, right? Like this is both affecting us, this thing, right? And that we're both kind of have agency that we can, you know, enact change. And once we start describing these high risk situations and these warning signs and these types of things, that it just kind of allows them to join in a very specific and meaningful way. Which I'm really glad to hear that, you know, Kevin has done some really cool analyses on that. Also shout out, Kevin Hallgren, who just does some of the coolest data analysis stuff ever
totally.
Anyway. So,
yeah.
We definitely got to get Kev on the show.
He's a great guy. I mean, just he's a fabulous scientist and just a wonderful human being.
Oh, completely agree.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we're sort of coming up on time, but before we mm-hmm. jump into our take home messages, I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the evidence, you know, what does the evidence suggest, you know, the efficacy is, for ABCT?
Okay. Well, let's see. I'm going to try to consolidate my answer across a lot of studies.
Sure.
Overall, people decrease their drinking or stop. When we've compared ABCT to individually focused treatment, some of our studies say that it's more efficacious in terms of changing drinking. Not all of our studies have found that. Tim O'Farrell also has done a lot of work in this area, and his studies also have found the ABCT tends to work better than individually focused treatment. We always see improvements in relationship functioning. And in our very earliest studies, we even found that couples were less likely to separate or divorce. Hmm. In our work with women, wow, in particular, we found that, and this was a complete surprise to us, that people did better with the couple therapy than individual therapy when they had another Axis I disorder. Totally surprised me. I thought, well, they'd really do better with the individual treatment in that situation, but that wasn't true. We've tried a combination of kind of a blended individual and couple treatment. And again, that was with women. And that worked really well in terms of retention. People were much more likely to stay in when they had some of those individual sessions. And part of that's is pragmatic. It's hard to schedule all the sessions. Therapists need to be flexible in terms of their hours. Couples need to find time that they can be seen together. And some of the barriers really are very pragmatic to being able to come to couple treatment. And a lot of couples who are working often in blue collar kinds of jobs may have their lives organized if they've got kids to work opposite shifts and have just a little bit of childcare in between with a relative. And then we're saying, come in every week. They're like, we don't have much time. But that's a basic summary. It's an efficacious treatment. It's supported through multiple studies, through multiple investigators, and APA has listed as an efficacious treatment. So that's the really quick summary.
Are there any specific like population level characteristics or participant level characteristics that kind of influence these different outcomes? Like some people do better than others. It sounds like some like logistical things for sure. As a person who's done this kind of therapy before, you can only do it in the evening. It was basically like the time I could do it was like 6 o'clock. It was like after everybody got off work and such. But are there any like race, gender, things like that people need to be thinking about?
Yeah, there's really not good research out there related to race or sexual orientation. I'm a collaborator on a study with Julianne Flanagan, who's at Medical University of South Carolina, which is they're using the ABCT module or the treatment. But what she's really looking at is the influence of oxytocin on treatment,
Right.
which I think is super cool. And I do the some of the supervision. And they've been really deliberate in reaching out to the LGBT community and trying to really recruit people of color into the study. And it's probably the first study that's really been explicit about that. So we really don't have good data there. With women, we've found the women who engage in couple therapy do really, really well with it. We had one study where we gave women a choice of individual or couple therapy, and then each whatever choice they made that was a randomized trial of couple therapy or a randomized trial of two different individual therapies, and we found that a lot of the women did not want couple therapy, and we went back and did a content analysis of why that was so. A couple of my students, Ben Ladd actually and Kevin Hallgren, when he just had started at UNM, we worked together on that. And we found that the women, some of them said, a lot of people said, my male partner drinks or uses drugs and I don't think he could be helpful. Some women talked about logistics. Some said, this is my issue and I feel like I need to work this out myself. And then some women, we've even found in the couple therapy, some women find it really embarrassing. And they feel kind of They don't like being, they feel very put down by having a discussion about their drinking with their partner there. But then other women who chose the couple therapy said, well, you know, we're in this together and I need his support and that kind of thing. So with women, I think there's a little bit more discomfort with the couples model. But when they do the couple therapy, they do really, really well with it.
That's really interesting. And I forgot that Ben Ladd worked with you as well, who is also another great person and producing some really interesting research up there in the Northwest.
He was my first UNM grad student.
Oh, okay. Very cool. Well, thank you so much for that. I mean, this has been really enlightening. I've really enjoyed talking about it and learning about this therapy. And I was wondering if you'd be ready to move into the take-home messages.
Can I say one thing about my major? Just like I was going to name my major collaborators. So,
absolutely.
So three people that probably would be less, people would be less aware of when we first started this work. Bill Hay, who was a psychologist at Brown, and then David Abrams and then Nora Noel. We were the early ones who first developed the treatment. When I moved to Rutgers, then Beth Epstein, she's been my longtime collaborator. And then since I've been at UNM, in addition to collaborating with Beth and with Julianne Flanagan, Brandy Fink has been a really great collaborator. And since I've been here, Scott Tonagan has been just great in terms of working with me in terms of analyzing data and all. So and there are tons of students, but I just want to say this doesn't happen in a vacuum. My name may be attached to it, but it's just a lot of really great people I've been working with and lucky to work with over a long time.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the sentiment. You know, this is a team sport and, I think that is really lovely to name all those people.
Agreed. And yeah. If there ever was a time where the message, it takes a village, right? Like made perfect sense, mm-hmm. both from academically and from the intervention. This is that time, right? Like none of this stuff happens without multiple collaborations and things like that. So
for sure.
I think it's really important to name those people, and thank you for doing it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, let's jump into the take homes now. So mm-hmm. what do you think the take home message is for people who are in recovery or, you know, who may be interested in changing their substance use?
Okay. Well, it's a pretty generic kind of message, but the first thing is just stick with it. There are lots of pathways to change. And I think for any person, the challenge is to find the pathway for them and not to give up if the first thing they try doesn't work. And the second part of that message is really seek help and support from other people. You are part of a village and that village can help you.
Agreed. What do you think the take-home message is about ABCT for practitioners out there who might be listening?
Use it. maybe a little more than that.
Short and sweet.
Yeah, agreed.
Get family involved. Yeah. And you know, it is a whole developed treatment, but you can use pieces of it. But get families involved in the treatment. And it's a little scary at first, but it's incredibly fun and incredibly rewarding, and you're going to get better outcomes.
What would your take-home message be for policymakers?
Well, that's a really interesting one, because generally, at least insurance companies don't like to reimburse for family sessions or at least for meetings with family members. And so I think they should have that part of their policies. And just as a general thing, I think policymakers should be creating standards of care that are based on evidence. And unfortunately, that still doesn't happen as much as we would like it to, or I would like it to anyway.
Totally agree. What would you say the take-home message is for underserved populations?
I guess, I mean, the first thing is finding a practitioner that you feel comfortable with and finding a program that you feel comfortable with. Because unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there still who don't have the skills, knowledge, or attitudes to be able to work effectively with underserved populations. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really part of it. It depends on the group, but so, you know, so certainly some underserved populations, community is incredibly important, and you should, you know, like take advantage of your community to help you with making change.
Yeah, I love that point. So one last question, before, you know, we let you go. You know, you're very busy, but you know, you've had a really incredibly successful career, done a lot, worked with a lot of different people. And aside from just this therapy, you know, you've made a huge impact on a number of other areas. So do you have any advice for any trainees out there, how they might be able to make an impact like you?
Well, I don't think they should worry about making an impact. You know, my first piece of advice is really find your passion and pursue it. You know, if you've gone to a clinical science program, but you decide you want to be a practitioner, do it. If you're in a PsyD program and you decide you want to be a researcher, you should do it. Find the content area that you love and that you care about. So I think that that's really, really important. I think balance in your life is important. Finding other things that you care about deeply, finding someone to love. It could be a human or an animal, but I think that, you know, that's really, really important part of life. And being a successful professional is having caring in your life. I would say give credit to others. Listen more than you talk, as a general thing, because that way you learn from other people. Stand up for yourself, and particularly for women and people who come from diverse backgrounds, it's easy to get marginalized. Don't let it happen. This is a be kind and listen and all of that, but have a little steel in your belly at the same time. And don't forget your ethics. Whatever you're going to do, your ethical standards have to guide what you're going to do.
Thank you so much.
That's my best advice for today.
That's wonderful advice. Very good advice. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We've really appreciated it. Just thank you.
Thanks for having me and for doing this. It's a great service for our field.
Next time on The Addiction Psychologist, we will have Dr. Mary Beth Miller join us. Dr. Miller is an assistant professor at the University of Missouri School of Medicine, and she's going to be talking to us about her work on the intersection between sleep and substance use. Do not miss this episode.